Besançon. And he will speak about... No, there is no title.
No.
Holomorphic functional characters and non-commutative groups.
Okay, thank you very much. I would like to thank the organizers for the invitation to Vancouver and the opportunity to talk. So the starting point for this talk is some classical work of Stein going back to the 70s on harmonic analysis of semigroups and applications to Fourier multipliers and connections and generalizations of the Littlewood-Pellet theory. Stein studied some functional calculus for some special classes of analytic semigroups on classical commutative LP spaces and square functions associated to these semigroups and applications to Fourier multipliers on LP. Since then, his work has been developed in many different directions. Here I will be more particularly interested in one of them called the H-infinity functional calculus. And in this talk, I will present some joint work with Marius Junge and Ken Uesche, which is an attempt to generalize this commutative theory to a non-commutative setting. In particular, we obtain some applications to Fourier multipliers on non-commutative LP spaces. But of course, first of all, I will now briefly explain the commutative theory and the general definitions. So as I said, we want to study some analytic semigroups on non-commutative LP spaces. The best framework to study analytic semigroups is probably the one of introduced by Kato under the name of sectorial operators. So we start with a Banach space, and by definition, a sectorial operator is an operator A, which may be unbounded and defined on the domain of X, on the domain which is a subspace of X. We have a technical condition that A is closed and densely defined, but it's not important for the general idea. And we define some sectors like that for an angle omega, which is here. We consider this sector of numbers whose argument is between minus omega and plus omega. And by definition, the operator A is sectorial of type omega if it satisfies these two conditions. The first one is the most important one. It says that the spectrum of A, which may be unbounded, is contained in this sector. And the second one, which is a technical one, we will come to it later, says that whenever you take an angle greater than omega, an angle theta, then you have a uniform estimate for the resolvent of the operator as long as you ask Z to be outside of this bigger sector. And the connection between this definition and semigroups is given by these two well-known facts. First of all, if you take a bounded C0 semigroup on your Banach space X, and if you let minus A be its generator, then A is sectorial of type pi over 2. For instance, the first of the two conditions here just says that in that case, the spectrum of A is in the right half plane of C, and which is a very well-known fact, and the second one is easy to prove. And the next step, which is maybe more important, is that if you start with a semigroup with this property of sectoriality, the sectoriality has type strictly less than pi over 2, which means some sort of picture like that, if and only if minus A generates a bounded analytic semigroup. So what is a bounded analytic semigroup? It's simply like a bounded C0 semigroup on your Banach space, which admits a bounded analytic extension on some sector of that type. Okay, existence of a holomorphic or analytic extension of the semigroups. And these two numbers are related. The sum of them is pi over 2. So what it means? It means if you have a small type, you have an extension of the semigroup on a big sector. Okay, so when you have such an operator, you can define a functional calculus which has the following definition. Okay, you introduce the algebra of holomorphic bounded analytic function on a sector of corresponding to an angle bigger than omega, which is that one. It has this, the usual norm, which is the soup norm. And the idea, we skip this definition for the moment. Let's come to this formula. The idea is to define an operator f of a associated to f and a by this Cauchy integral, which is the same as the definition of the Ries functional calculus, the classical one. But the main difference here is that what is the classical Ries functional calculus? You start in that case with a bounded operator, and you consider a domain omega, which contains a spectrum in the interior, and you take such a contour, and you take the integral over the contour of this kind of operator-valued functions. The difficulty here is that in our setting, the spectrum may be unbounded, and the spectrum may contain zero, which makes this integral a singular integral. It may not converge. So to make this definition, we have to consider only special functions f, and this is where this definition is important. We consider the subalgebra of functions which have this property to go to zero at zero and infinity, at least like a power. This is the meaning. And if you consider this condition and that one, and you see that this integral is absolutely convergent, and this defines a bounded operator on x. So this is the starting point for the functional calculus associated to a sectorial operator. And there is a second step, which consists in defining f of a for a general function f. I don't give here the complete definition. It's obtained by approximation from h 0 infinity. But let me simply say that it satisfies this formula, we start with a technical assumption which is not important at all. And what does this formula say? Well, this formula holds for the definition I don't give here. And the formula says, okay, if A has a dense range, it's easy to find G in that space so that G of A has a dense range. And this belongs to this space. So this is a well-defined operator by this formula. So this formula defines f of a on the range of g of a. So this defines f of a on a dense subspace. But the point is that in that definition, f of a may be unbounded. And this is a starting point of a general problem of boundedness of such operators, f of a defined by such formulas. The point being that this definition does not depend on g. And this leads to the following definition, which was introduced by Alan McIntosh. First, there is a theorem, which is that these operators for arbitrary functions, f, are all bounded operators if and only if you restrict to the subalgebra, which is here, for which you have the definition with the Cauchy integral, if and only if for these operators you have a uniform estimate. And this is a theorem because this subalgebra is not dense, so it's sort of approximation principle. And in that case, we say that A admits a bounded H infinity sigma theta functional calculus. Okay, so my set of definitions is not complete because I didn't give any detail here, but what I want to explain now is that in practical it's not important, because what we often have and what we will have in this talk is that situation. Very often A is given as a diagonal operator with respect to some Schauder basis. There's some formula like this for a sequence AN belonging to some sector. And in that case, it turns out that this definition that I didn't explain well, it's consistent with such a relation. I mean, for any f, f of a will be the diagonal operator corresponding to f of a n. And in that case, you see that the boundedness of such operator will correspond to the boundedness of the multiplier associated to this sequence with respect to this Schauder basis. So this is why, this is mainly why this subject has many connections with theories of multipliers, Fourier multipliers and Schur multipliers and others. Because when you apply this theory to this kind of operators, you get a way to study multipliers. So for instance, let me give the simplest example of that situation. The simplest example is the Poisson semigroup. So you consider the unit circle in the complex plane, and as a Banach space you take LP, as a basis you take the exponential, and for AN you take the absolute value of N for any N, for any integer. Then in that case, the operator which is here corresponds to the generator of the Poisson semigroup, where here this is the Poisson kernel. So the convolution with the Poisson kernel. And indeed in that case, f of a will take a function with Fourier expansion written that way to that one. So in that case, for that example, the boundedness of f of a will correspond to the boundedness of the Fourier multiplier associated to this sequence. And it turns out that in that situation, yes, a has a bounded h-infinity functional calculus for any angle. And this is just an application of some classical work on Fourier multipliers, and especially the one known as Micklin theorem. So this is a generic example for that situation. And what I will try to explain at the end of the talk is some non-commutative generalizations of these situations. Let me just briefly give some history for that subject. So as I said at the beginning, the starting point is the book by Stein, Topics in Harmonic Analysis. And there was an important paper by Michael Cowling on multipliers and functional calculus on LP, but all these formal definitions were introduced by Alan McIntosh in 86, and then there were these two important papers. This one began to circulate at the beginning of the 90s, and since then there were many, many papers on that subject. I just gave the beginning of the list and the origin of the subject. Okay. Okay, so these definitions make sense for any Banach space. Now I will restrict to LP spaces, and I will explain one of the main results of this paper by Cowling, Daoust, McIntosh, and Yagi. This main result is the following one. So you are on LP with P non-trivial P strictly between 1 and infinity. P between 1 and infinity, and you start with your sectorial operator, and you consider this kind of integrals, which are called square functions. What is it? You take a function f in that set, which is the set of all possible functions in H0 infinity of sigma theta for theta which is bigger than omega, and we avoid zero to avoid some stupid statements. And here, f of t a of x is a function, it's an element of LP. So this is a pointwise definition for any element in that measure space. You calculate this integral, and then you consider the corresponding functions defined on omega, and you take the LP norm. And this defines the square function associated to f. And this may be finite or infinite. Okay, this may be infinite. And one of the main theorems from this paper says that when A has a bounded H-infinity functional calculus, then whenever you take a function f with an angle corresponding to an angle bigger than this theta, all these square functions are finite and you have such an estimate. And the connection with Stein's work, which is here, and the Littlewood Pellet theory is given by this special case. Now consider the case when theta is strictly less than pi over 2, which corresponds in particular to the case when you study a unbounded analytic semigroup. In that case, so you consider this semigroup, which is bounded and analytic, and you consider that function. And that function, well, is relevant to this this because it belongs to that space H0 infinity of sigma theta for any theta strictly less than pi over 2. So you can apply this definition to this function, and in that case you see that f of ta of x is just t times the partial derivative of tt of x with respect to t, and that expression exactly corresponds to that one. And what was in Stein's book, for instance, were estimates of these integrals. So this kind, here we recover what is now called Littlewood-Pellet-Stein inequalities, that for some semigroups, like the Poisson semigroup, for instance, this square function is less than constant times the usual norm of x. Okay. Now another result concerning classical LP spaces, which is an equivalence result. This is maybe less important. I have many definitions here, but it's not very... This one is the most important one. Let's turn to that one. The question I want to consider here briefly is the equivalence of different square functions when you change the function f. And, the main theorem is that one, but it has an assumption, and I will discuss the assumption in a minute. So under some assumption, which is here, we have the result that for any pairs of functions in this space, which is defined here as a space of admissible functions to study the square functions, you have this equivalence, these two square functions are equivalent. And what is this assumption? This assumption refers to some notion called Rademacher boundedness, which is easy to explain for those which are acquainted with Rademacher averages. So if you have a Banach space and if you have a set of operators, then we say that the set is Rademacher bounded or Rad bounded if there is an estimate of that type, which says that whenever you take t1, tn in the set and x1, xn in x, then the Rademacher average of this xi's dominates the one of the ti xi's. And this leads to a definition of... Let me try to... This leads to a definition of Rademacher sectoriality. If you remember, and if I can find the definition of sectoriality. All right. In the definition of sectoriality, the second point was the boundedness of the certain set of operators here. And if you replace the boundedness by the Rademacher boundedness, you get to the notion of Rademacher sectoriality. So this is the meaning of this assumption. But it's not very important. Just keep in mind some, under some quite simple assumption, you have this equivalence of norms. And the most important thing is the corollary. The corollary is that... Oops. Okay, so I give you again this theorem. So under the assumption of H infinity calculus, we had this inequality. Now the corollary is we have a reversed inequality. And this is a combination of several things. The first one is that in their paper, Cowling, Doust, McIntosh, and Yagi proved that for one function, and the second result is a result by Kelton and Weiss, which says that this assumption implies a rod sectoriality. And then if you combine these two results with the theorem above, you get the equivalence for any function. So this is there should be a C here, a constant C here. So you get this result. So the final thing is that under this assumption of H-boundedness, of H-infinity calculus, these square functions are equivalent to the usual norms. Okay. So let me now come to non-commutative LP spaces. Okay, so, well, H-infinity functional calculus is defined on any Banach space, so it makes sense to consider that notion on non-commutative LP spaces. But what about square functions? So for square functions, let me see. We start with a semi-finite von Neumann algebra, and we work on the Banach space, the non-commutative LP space associated to this von Neumann algebra, and we start with a sectorial operator of type omega. And now, as I said, we are facing the problem of defining suitable square functions. So the natural idea, of course, is to replace the module of the function by the module of the operator. You have to keep in mind that now f of t a of x is an operator, so we can take this definition. I put some C here to refer to the column structure, so let me explain what I mean here. I mean that this is well known to you, of course, that if you consider an interval of elements of LP of m tau, and if you consider the column matrix with entries x1, xn, and if you compute the LP norm of this matrix, then you find the norm of the square root of this sum. So in some sense, this definition corresponds to consider some sort of continuous column indexed by t and with entries f of tax. Okay. But of course, you know that in general, except when p equals 2, this may be different from the same with the star on the right. So we have to consider also the row version of this definition, which is the same as above but with the star here. And now the question is, what is a good definition of a square function for which this theorem will hold in the non-commutative setting? So the answer, well, is not surprising in some sense. It follows a principle which goes back to the non-commutative Kinchin inequalities. I will now remind you that. The non-commutative Kinchin inequalities due to Françoise Lustpica in 86 say that when you consider Rademacher average of an interval on a non-commutative LP space, then the norm you obtain here is equivalent to two different kind of things depending on whether p is greater than 2 or smaller than 2. In the case when p is bigger than 2, this norm is equivalent to the maximum of the column and the row norms that we considered here. And in the case when p is smaller than 2, this norm is equivalent to this infimum, where we consider all possible decompositions of xi as a sum yi plus zi. And here we consider the the column norm corresponding for the yi and the row norm for the zi's. And this phenomenon has been developed this phenomenon also appears in the work by Pizzi and Chu on square functions associated to non-commutative martingales. And this phenomenon of dichotomy and between p greater than 2 and p smaller than 2 also appears in this setting. So not surprisingly, we have two different situations depending on whether p is bigger or smaller than 2. So when p is bigger than 2, the good square function is the maximum of the column and the row norm. Column and row norms, which are defined here and here. And if we take that definition for the square function of f, then we have the same kind of results as in the commutative case. That is, under the assumption of Rademacher sectoriality, all these square functions are equivalent. And second, if we assume that A has a bounded H-infinity functional calculus, then these square functions are equivalent to the original norm. And in particular, we have this kind of inequalities. This one is smaller than that one, which leads to some non-commutative Littlewood-Palestine inequalities when we start with a bounded analytic semigroup. When we are in that situation that I explained before, we get... If we are able to prove such a property for a semigroup, for the generator of a semigroup, we get to some non-commutative Littlewood-Palestine inequalities of that type. And the same, for instance, for the same with the star here. In the case when p is smaller than 2 now, the situation is similar to the one I explained for the non-commutative Kinsheim's inequalities. So here again you have to consider decomposition and an infimum. So you start with... You will get the same results, so you will get this kind of results when the square function is defined by this infimum, where you start, for a given x, you start with the function f of tax, and you consider all possible decompositions into the sum of two functions, u1 and u2, and you compute these integrals. So this is very, very similar to the situation of non-commutative Kinsheim's inequality. Now, when you are in that situation, you are facing a new problem. It may be more natural, more interesting, to consider this definition, but with restricting u1 and u2 to functions of the form f of ta of something. So it leads to the following alternative definition. We may define another square function which corresponds to taking the infimum of the column square function of x1, row square function of x2 over all pairs x1 and x2 whose sum is equal to x. It corresponds to restrict to functions u1 and u2 of that form. Of course, by definition, since this is an infimum over a smaller set, this square function is bigger than that one. And we don't know at this time whether they are equivalent. But we have some sort of partial result, which is that in the case when A admits a completely bounded H-infinity calculus, we have not only the equivalence between the original norm and the square function, which is defined at the top, but also equivalence with the square function, which is defined here. Okay, so we need some sort of extra assumption, complete boundedness of H infinity functional calculus. So I won't write a definition of what it means. It's quite transparent. Our non-commutative LP spaces have an natural operator space structure, which is given by the interpolation structure introduced by Pisier. So when we have our operators F of A defined from LP into LP, instead of their boundedness, instead of the regular norm, we can consider the completely bounded norm. We can ask, and this leads to the definition of this completely bounded H infinity functional calculus. It will mean that the estimates we wrote for the norm are hold true for the completely bounded norm. Okay, so this is a set of theoretical results we have. I should also say that in that non-commutative setting, there are some natural extensions of the notion of rad boundedness and rad sectoriality, which are the column boundedness, row boundedness, and associated sectoriality, which corresponds to, well, maybe I should just show you something. This is not very important, but I just mentioned that we can introduce some sort of some notion of column boundedness in the same way, which is similar to the definition of Rademacher boundedness, and this leads to the notion of column sectoriality. And what I wanted to say here, let's just go to that theorem. This theorem of independence of square functions under the assumption of Rademacher sectoriality holds true if you restrict to column square functions. If you consider the different column square functions, they will be equivalent under the assumption of column sectoriality. And there are some new, well, of course, all these notions coincide in the commutative case. So it's only interesting for the non-commutative case. And we have some different, new problems arising from these notions. But I don't want to go too far in that direction. And in the last 10 minutes, I would like to give you some examples. Well, I have prepared two examples. The first one is what I call Hagerup's non-commutative Poisson. Let me go with that one. That one is better. Yes. Hagerup's non-commutative Poisson semigroup. So it will be some sort of non-commutative analog of the first example, the generic example of Poisson semigroup I gave at the beginning. So I remind you a few notations. When you start with a discrete group with unit E, you can associate the group von Neumann algebra, which is defined as the von Neumann algebra generated by the left translation operators acting on the L2 space associated to G. And this is a finite von Neumann algebra for this trace. This is all classical. And you then define non-commutative LP spaces that I denote by LP of G. Now let me consider the special case of the free group. So G is a free group with n generators that I denote by A1 and AN. Any element of the free group, the elements of the free groups are some words by definition, so you can write any G of this group as the product AI1, K1, AI2, K2, etc., where I1 is different from I2, I2 is different from I3, etc., and the KJs are non-zero integers. And this leads to the notion of, to the definition of the length of the word, which is the sum of the modulus of the powers which appear here. And on the linear span of translation operators, you can define an operator A by taking lambda of G to lambda of G times the length of G. So this is exactly the kind of situation I explained at the beginning when A is defined as a diagonal with respect to some sort of basis. Okay, so here the basis is that one. And that in that case, A, or more precisely minus A, will be the generator of an analytic semigroup, which is a semigroup which satisfies that property, T of T. Okay, I forgot to write, of course. TT will be exponential minus TA, as you can see. So minus A will generate such a semigroup, which takes lambda of G to lambda of G times this number. And this semigroup was introduced by Hagerup to study something completely different, which was the completely bounded approximation property. But this was introduced by Hagerup for such purpose, and this is an extension of the classical Poisson semigroup, because when n equals to 1, then in that case g equals to z, and this is exactly the Poisson semigroup. And the result is that one. For any p strictly between 1 and infinity, and for any angle which with this condition which comes from interpolation, I don't want to give any details here, A admits a bounded, actually a completely bounded, but completely is not very important, a bounded H-infinity calculus with respect to this angle theta on LP of F sub n. So that result will imply in particular the boundedness of such Fourier multipliers in this setting of non-commutative LP spaces whenever F is a function belonging to H infinity of sigma theta for theta bigger than this critical angle. And also for this semigroup, you will get some non-commutative Littlewood-Pellestein inequalities as I explained before. The second example I would like to explain is the number operator on fermions. So here we work on the hyperfinite 2-1 factor. So this may be described as a Von-Neumann algebra generated by a sequence of fermions, a sequence of Hermitian unitaries, satisfying these canonical anti-commutation relations. And for any set of positive integers with I1 strictly less than I2, etc., until IN, then you can consider this product W sub J, and these will the linear span of these elements will be a weak star, dense star algebra of M. And you, on this Von-Neumann algebra, you have a natural trace, which is, defined on P that way and with a suitable extension. And again, you have a setting for a non-commutative LP spaces, which is the one associated to this trace. And again, I define an operator A just on that subspace without saying too much about closures and extensions. At this stage, you just define A as the diagonal operator with respect to this basis with eigenvalues equals to the cardinal of the set J. So this operator is a well-known operator called the number operator. And again, we have a similar result, which is, essentially the same as that one. Okay, so the same result holds for the number operator. We have some similar consequences. I would like to say a word on this condition. If you if you consider the classical Poisson semi-group, the angle can be, this result holds for any positive angle, and here we have a restriction, and it comes from the proof itself, but we don't know if this can be extended to the case of any angle. This is, at this stage, it's still an open question. And last thing, it turns out that this example here is a special case of a more general result, but I don't have time. I don't give too many definitions, but okay, it's that example. More generally, if you consider a finite von Neumann algebras generated by the Q-Gaussian variables over a real Hilbert space and corresponding to some number Q between minus 1 and 1, and if you consider the what is called in the literature the Q-Ornstein-Uhlenbeck semigroup on that von Neumann algebra, then you will have a similar result of boundedness of the H-infinity functional calculus on LP of associated to this von Neumann algebra. And this case here corresponds to the value Q equals minus 1. So you have this more general situation. And, okay, I stop here.
To state the result on three products, something like three products, two semi-groups.
Yes. Yes, we thought about that. Yes, we, and there are some positive results in that direction, which I used to in the preceding example.
In the classical literature. I'm not familiar with the classical literature. Mm-hmm. After they proved a theorem like this, how do you use multiplier theorems? That's a vague question.
Which you mean? What kind of functions? What kind of functions?
Yeah.
Okay, in the classical literature, the favorite functions are what are what is called the imaginary powers. If you consider this such a function with real S, such a function belongs to H infinity of any sector, and the corresponding operator is called the imaginary power. And this plays some role in the study of differential operator in the classical case. In his book, Stein called when A was for a diffusion semigroup, such an operator was called is a risk potential. It plays some role in the study of differential operator. I should say first that in the classical situation, concrete examples come from PDEs. There are some differential operators associated to forms or these kind of things. And these kinds of operators are called the risk potentials and are important to study the regularity of Cauchy problems associated to the differential operators. The boundedness of these operators is important, of the risk potentials. So the main example of functions are that ones, these ones.
And is there quantum analysis?
Well, I don't know. Of course we can state something, but there is no development at this moment of PDEs on non-commutative LP spaces.
Any more questions, comments? Yes, if not, then we will resume at 11:40.